Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kodalska. On today's show, we'll get a breakdown of the Wyoming Supreme Court decision on abortion. And the property tax bill for your home might be going away, maybe forever. That's if some state lawmakers get their way.
It would be a seismic shift in policy, and it would be a change that may be fatal.
We'll also hear how, despite a federal boost, coal still struggled in 2025.
Even the White House can't offset markets, and markets are really the final determinant of whether coal is going to be around in the power generation market.
And local community fundraising is becoming more important to some Laramie-based nonprofits.
When times are uncertain, it's really important that we are able to raise funds to help meet the need in other ways as well.
Those stories and more coming up on Open Spaces.
This time on the Modern West, a fired Forest Service worker is left scrambling to find a place to live while she finishes building her straw bale house. Luckily, she's got friends.
The community aspect is definitely big. People are always like, you know, building things and more hands, less work, so.
Many hands make light work. It's part five of our series, Cheap Dirt. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kodalska. To kick off 2026, let's start off with some big news. The Wyoming Supreme Court has upheld abortion access, closing a chapter in the battle over abortion rights in the state. It struck down two near-total abortion laws. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Merzbach is here to get us up to speed. Thanks for sharing your reporting.
Thanks for having me.
So let's get to the basics of the ruling. What were the justices looking at?
They were looking at the constitutionality of two abortion laws passed by the Wyoming legislature. Like in many conservative states, Wyoming lawmakers have been trying to ban most abortions ever since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022. That returned decision-making power over abortion access back to states. So in 2023, Wyoming lawmakers passed the Life is a Human Right Act, which banned most abortions. They also passed a medical abortion ban, which banned abortion pills in most cases.
Okay, and so you said most abortions. Did either of these laws have any exceptions?
Yes, both laws have exceptions for sexual assault and incest, if it's reported to law enforcement. They also have exceptions for when abortions are needed to prevent the death of the pregnant woman. For the Life is a Human Right Act specifically, there's also exceptions for lethal fetal anomalies or molar pregnancies, which could both be lethal to the fetus. There's also exceptions for medical treatment to a pregnant woman that results in an accidental or unintentional injury or death of the, quote, unborn baby. I should note, one study from Kaiser Family Foundation found laws like this don't always account for all situations. They've resulted in women being unable to get medical care until their lives are on the line.
Okay, but as I understand it, these laws have not been in effect. Is that correct?
Yeah, they were only in effect for a few days when they first passed. Since then, a group of abortion access advocates have been suing the state and getting them blocked in court.
And how did those lower court cases play out?
So in the end of 2024, a Teton County district judge struck the laws down. She said they violate the state constitution. The state then appealed that decision to the Wyoming Supreme Court. There was a hearing back in mid-April. Now, after months of waiting, the majority of justices say they agree with the district court that these laws violate the state constitution.
So it all comes back to the Constitution. What part of it did they say the laws violate?
Article 1, Section 38. That says, quote, each competent adult shall have the right to make his or her own health care decisions, unquote. This was added to the state constitution in 2012 by a majority of Wyoming voters. Lawmakers say they put it on the ballot as a way to oppose Obamacare. They didn't like the tax penalties people faced at the time for not having insurance.
Senate will come to order.
Here's then-Senator Drew Perkins on the floor. He's now the governor's chief of staff. This was back when lawmakers were considering the amendment.
And that's what this is about.
my fellow senators, I think is about choice, about whether you're going to free to choose it, whether you're free not to choose it.
But even back then, lawmakers worried there'd be unintended consequences of keeping the amendment so broad. They were worried how courts would interpret it, and even about abortion issues. Here's former Senator Philip Nicholas.
Suppose the issue is the person's right to reproductive options. That's a health care decision. And it seems to me that a competent adult under this should have that right. I do believe that it creates a lot of issues that you really have to begin to wonder on second reading whether or not this is an appropriate constitutional amendment with a new guarantee.
But lawmakers moved the amendment forward anyway. And now it's coming back to bite the many lawmakers in the legislature today who want to ban abortion.
Interesting. So what arguments did the Wyoming Supreme Court specifically make?
Under that constitutional amendment, the legislature may determine reasonable and necessary restrictions on these rights to protect the health and general welfare of the people, or to accomplish the other purposes set forth in the Wyoming Constitution. The majority, including Chief Justice Lynn Boomgarden, former Justice Kate Fox, and Justice Robert Jarosz, said the state didn't present enough evidence to show the abortion laws are no more restrictive than necessary, aka they aren't as narrow as possible, or the least burdensome way the state could do this. Justice John Fenn arrived at the same conclusion, with a slightly different line of thinking. There was one dissent opinion, Justice Carrie Jo Gray. She said the laws constitute a reasonable and necessary restriction and don't violate Article 1, Section 38. That's because of the exceptions, such as for rape and incest.
So how have people been reacting?
Jackson Hole OBGYN Jovanina Anthony said this is a huge win. She's part of the group suing the state to protect abortion access.
I don't have to lie to patients about what they can and can't do. I don't have to send them out of state. I don't have to figure out how to fly them somewhere.
To places like Montana or Colorado, where abortion's legal. The Wyoming Democratic Caucus also celebrated. They said they'll continue to stand up for the Constitution. But many Wyoming officials aren't so happy. Speaker of the House and State Freedom Caucus member Chip Nyman says the ruling's a, quote, abomination.
Those little unborn human beings, those little men and women, those girls and boys in the womb have rights. Who's listening to their voices? I can hear them. I don't know about you, but I can hear them.
Nyman says lawmakers are drafting bills right now to ask voters to amend the state constitution again. It's unclear what that'll look like, but he says he wants that to recognize life in the womb. Lawmakers could pass that language this session that starts February 9th. That would go to voters as early as this fall. Governor Mark Gordon says he supports putting this to a vote. He said the Wyoming Supreme Court ruling settles a legal question, but not a moral one. He's also directed the attorney's office to file a petition to rehear the case.
And as I understand, some of these elected officials are also saying that the justices are too liberal.
Yeah, we're hearing that from members of the Freedom Caucus and Secretary of State Chuck Gray. Some say they want to bring back a draft bill that died earlier this year. That could require Senate approval for Supreme Court appointments. Right now, a nominating commission selects candidates and the governor picks one.
This is how government works, right? I mean, the system of checks and balances, the three branches.
Representative Andrew Byron objects to all of this. He's a moderate Republican from Jackson, and he's pro-choice. He voted against the two abortion laws.
And to immediately go after the Wyoming State Supreme Court justices and say that they got it wrong. I mean, that's the process we have. If folks don't like that, maybe they should, you know, reconsider what country they live in.
Okay, so what's next with all of this?
We'll likely see lawmakers consider language for a constitutional amendment. That language needs a two-thirds vote from both chambers. Then to pass, it would need a majority from voters participating in the November election. We're also going to see that petition from the state to rehear the case. That needs to come within 15 days of the decision. We could also see more bills restricting abortion in other ways. The legislature's already passed laws requiring ultrasounds for abortion seekers or building renovations at abortion clinics. Those have also been held up in the courts. I'll keep you all updated on what we see next.
Well, thanks so much for this update, Hannah.
Yeah, of course.
Wyoming lawmakers are considering doing away with all taxation on land that's used for housing. Sweeping efforts are becoming more common in other states, too. But some people view property tax as a bedrock in maintaining local government services. Wyoming Public Radio's Chris Clements reports that a growing anti-tax sentiment could shift that landscape.
The idea of eliminating residential property taxes troubles Adelaide Myers. She's a board member for a library system in Carbon County in southern Wyoming. It's vast and sparsely populated. People there depend on their libraries, not just for books, but for places to get online and do things like write resumes.
This would be really bad for our counties, our municipalities, our schools, all of our districts, to just take away property taxes.
Myers, who started a letter-writing campaign highlighting the need for property taxes, has lost more than half her budget as lawmakers have already been reducing property taxes.
We're bending over backwards to keep these libraries open, and our communities care so much that they're making a lot of noise.
But it's not just libraries. Firefighters and other first responders are worried too. That includes Leighton Bergen, an EMT with a rural fire district near Casper. He envisions a dark future if property taxes continue to dwindle.
Every second counts towards trying to save somebody's life, right? Long story short, it would be mean closing doors, maybe selling trucks.
But Gillette Senator Troy McEwen says those kinds of worries are overblown.
The sky's falling. It's all going to be over.
He's on the lawmaking committee reading those letters from Myers Library members. Wyoming's property taxes are the 12th lowest in the nation, but they're still not low enough for McEwen.
It's immoral. It's an unconstitutional tax to begin with.
Some lawmakers, like McEwen, view property tax as rent. You pay the government for land you already own.
We got to pull back. And there are people who are one or two big tax hikes away from losing their houses.
There are efforts to reduce or eliminate property taxes in Florida, Montana, Texas, North Dakota, and elsewhere. Anna Phillips, with the left-leaning Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, says they're going too far.
These kinds of just broad across-the-board cuts are essentially dropping the scalpel of the surgical approach that you would need in favor of a meat tenderizer.
An anti-tax sentiment has been growing, says Phil Roberts, professor emeritus of history at the University of Wyoming.
The real immigration of people into Wyoming with this attitude, I think, came about in the 70s and 80s, in more recent times.
Debates about taxation are as old as Wyoming, he says. The delegates who drafted the state constitution in 1889 adopted a property tax to keep any one individual or company, like railroads, from ending up with all the land without paying their share.
They didn't wish to promote a feudal state run by a group of corporations that didn't want to pay taxes but wanted to take advantage of all the resources the state had to offer.
The state long depended on coal mining and drilling for oil to keep taxes low for homeowners. And Robert says that drew people here. But removing all residential property taxes?
It would be a seismic shift in policy, and it would be a change that may be fatal because the future is not that rosy when minerals were becoming less and less valuable.
McEwen is backing higher sales taxes to make up for lost property tax revenue. Though he says sales taxes aren't expected to cover the gap of no residential property taxes. In McEwen's view, most local governments already have the money they need to get by.
There's plenty of money. It's just since COVID funding, everybody's kind of gotten fat and spoiled.
That viewpoint deflates local leaders like Adelaide Myers.
I'm honestly considering whether I want to continue to live in Wyoming if this all continues in this direction. What we're going to end up with is a race to the bottom.
If the effort to end all residential property taxation passes the legislature, it'll go before voters in 2026 as an amendment to the state constitution. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Chris Clements in Laramie.
Ski patrollers in our region are joining unions. Up next on Open Spaces, we hear about the most recent efforts in Jackson. Stay with us.
It can be hard to keep track of the news, but Wyoming Public Radio just made it a little easier. Now you can follow us on Apple News to get the latest stories from Wyoming right in the palm of your hand. Plus, you can get an audio roundup of daily local news in under 10 minutes with our new podcast. Check out Wyoming Debrief, a morning habit that pairs perfectly with your cup of coffee.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. At ski resorts across the country, patrollers are considering forming unions. This includes Jackson Hole Mountain Resort. Sophia Boyd-Fliegel with Jackson Hole Community Radio is here to give us an update. Welcome, Sophia.
Hey, hey.
So there's breaking news about this unionization effort.
Yeah. So on Friday morning, Jackson Hole Ski Patrol, which has like a little less than 100 people, updated its Instagram with a message that it had actually voted not to unionize at this time.
Okay, and why were they trying to unionize?
When Ski Patrol announced that they had the signatures to ask for a union vote, they sent out some pretty vague official statements that were generally pointing to just a desire for better compensation. The off-mic conversations that I had with patrollers were more specific for a desire for higher wages across the board, better health care, and mostly a hope that they could retain the younger generation of patrollers to stay, learn the mountain, and become a better team.
Okay, and at other ski areas like Le Massif, a major resort in Quebec, and Telluride in Colorado, patrollers have actually went on strike as negotiations broke down.
Yeah, so I spoke with Julia Caulfield, she's the news director at KOTO in Telluride, about what's happening down there. I wanted to understand what could happen here in Jackson, because from my conversations, I don't think that this fight for better compensation is going away. Telluride ski patrollers have been unionized for a decade now. Is this the first time they've gone on strike?
Yeah, so exactly as you mentioned, Ski Patrol in Telluride has been unionized for a decade. They negotiate their contracts with the ski resort every 3 years. Last year, they began contract negotiations in June. Their contract expired in August. And, you know, that is typical protocol, is that they will work with the resort over several months to negotiate a new contract. And this is the first time that they're striking. It's the first time that they've ever not gotten to that finish line before they get to this final stage.
Yeah, I would love to know more about that, because I have heard those voices of patrollers from your reporting who have said that they're pretty upset that it's come to this. Can you give me some more details of the negotiations? What exactly do patrollers want?
Yeah, you know, I think with many union negotiations, obviously, like, the most simple thing is it is about pay, right? They want higher wages. They believe they deserve those higher wages for what they will say is a professional and career job. Your listeners know in these mountain communities that are really expensive, where rent and mortgages can be thousands of dollars a month or whatever that might be. And so they have dropped some things from their original ask, including they asked for a healthcare stipend. They weren't asking for healthcare to be provided. And when I spoke with them, they didn't give exact numbers of kind of where they had lowered their ask to, but they did say that they've continued to come down. I will say on the flip side, Telski, the ski company, has said that the offer they've provided is a fair market leading wage.
Well, just give us a sense of scope right now for what Ski Patrol averages pay right now.
Yeah. So Currently, base rate for new patrollers going in is about $21 an hour. The last offer that Telski gave would have put a trainee ski patroller at $24 an hour, going up to specialist, which is on the higher end, which would be $39.60 an hour. And ski patrol leadership was saying that they want to work on a base wage structure and fixing what they see as a broken base wage structure rather than a bonus structure. The example that the vice president of the ski patrol union said, you know, you can't go to a mortgage lender and say, trust me on this loan, I'm going to get a bonus at the end of the year. I would say ski patrol on the whole is kind of aging. There's a lot of folks who have been with a mountain for 30, 40, 50 years, but they will say that this is a hard mountain and it will take 4, 5, 6 years to really feel like you know what you're doing. So for ski patrollers who come in and can't make it past year 2 or 3 because they can't afford it, then you're losing that institutional knowledge. You're losing that ability to have a really strong patrol that is really confident on the mountain.
That retention aspect, it sounds similar to the conversations I've been hearing here at Jackson Hole with our ski patrol. I would like to know now what the reaction has been like around town. We're talking here about an economy that, similar to Jackson Hole, is reliant on tourism. So what are people saying?
I would say on the whole, locals have been really supportive of ski patrol, at least publicly. You know, I think this is a hard conversation because it is really nuanced, right? I think there's a lot of people who support ski patrol, want them to get a fair wage, but at the same time, as you said, in a tourist economy, if people aren't coming here, that impacts everybody. We have seen that lodging numbers are down. And then you add on to it another level that is, you know, maybe impacting but not directly connected, is we don't have a good snow year either. And so, you know, even if all the lifts are open, it's not like it's a banner year for skiing.
Julia, thank you so much for your reporting and thanks for being here with me today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
And as we said at the top of this segment, Jackson Hole ski patrollers took a vote to unionize, but the effort did not pass. In a post to Instagram, they said, quote, "The petition and vote have created space for dialogue and to give new ownership the opportunity to listen and respond. Above all, we want to thank the ski community for the overwhelming support. We'll see you on the Hill." Sophia Boyd-Fliegel, thanks again for sharing your reporting.
You're quite welcome.
It's been about a year since Grand Teton National Park bought a square mile of land from the state of Wyoming for $100 million. The sale brought the inholding inside the boundaries of the park, protecting it from future development. Now, a cowboy who feels connected to the land and helped persuade lawmakers to conserve the Kelly parcel is feeling pushed out. Jackson Hole Community Radio's Dante Philpula Inkney reports from the parcel.
It's kind of hard to see with that dirty shoe there.
Jake Hutton kneels down holding his 6-year-old horse Ricky's hoof in his hands.
It's made out of a harder metal than the shoe. It's really grippy, so it grips in on the ice.
He walks me through special studs and other ads on Ricky's horseshoe that were welded in a place to ensure he can grip the snow and ice of a Wyoming winter.
Cool him down slow.
Oh, that's fascinating. So we could say that Ricky has his snow tires on.
Exactly. It's hard enough.
Smack in the middle of the 640-acre Kelly parcel, we're about to go for a ride. He finishes saddling Ricky and another quarter horse named Sally. I step into stirrups, sling a leg over the saddle. Hutton does the same, and with reins in hand, we're ready.
Yeah, sweet. So with these reins, pull straight back. If you come right here, then you're stuck and can't go left or right if you need to. So I'm just kind of holding one hand out in front.
Hutton and his fiancée, Sarah McIntosh, have around 30 horses they use for their young business, the JH Outfitting Company. They've come up with creative ways to make money and pay their roughly 15 employees, like renting out their burro to deliver drinks at special events or offering ski joring, pulling skiers behind their horse at the base of Jackson Hole Mountain Resort for those who want to try. Still, the majority of their revenue is made in the summer through trail rides, like the one we're on right now. Though some of the summer rides include live music, a full bar, and a 7-course meal. They've been able to make money on public land with a temporary use permit from the state. But the state doesn't own the parcel anymore. The feds do. So that temporary permit issued in 2022 that ran through 2027 is invalid. Early last year, Hutton asked Grand Teton National Park to allow him to continue the business through 2025. Park Superintendent Chip Jenkins.
And wanting to be good neighbors, wanting to be collaborative, we said, of course, we would be happy to do that.
Later, the park offered to honor the state's temporary permit on the original timeline. But that's it. Hutton and his partner would have to find a new spot for trail rides and cookouts. Ultimately, the park purchased the $100 million parcel at a premium.
For wildlife conservation, not for commercial activities.
Hutton hasn't signed the agreement. He wants to stay, and he feels slighted. He was a loud advocate for the park's purchase and conservation of the scenic habitat that came with encumbrances, he says, that include his business. That's due in part to the grazing rights he subleases. He also argues the park hasn't gone through the right process to protect the land's historic value. Back when this was being negotiated, the state legislature enshrined grazing and hunting rights to continue in perpetuity, Jenkins says, and it did not include commercial uses. Jackson Senator Mike Garrew was part of those negotiations. He agrees with Jenkins.
I would say that as the Park Service is the owner of the property, I would give them the latitude to decide what and what cannot be done on that property.
We can't have asked for a nice day, though.
Seriously, it's beautiful out.
At the top of a butte on the wildlife-rich tract overlooking the Tetons, Hutton says he and his fiance have put off their wedding due to the financial and mental stress of the impasse with the park. If they had to move,
it would ruin our business, to be honest. We would be sacrificing a lot and have to get really creative on how else we can survive with, you know, 30 horses that need a job.
Hutton has spoken up in the chambers of Teton County commissioners, even went to Capitol Hill seeking help from Wyoming's congressional delegation. He's sought out legal advice, though doesn't plan to sue as of right now. Without his own land, they will continue to rely on agreements with landowners to keep and graze their horses, and ultimately run their business.
Getting on a horse in Wyoming is important, you know. The first thing you see when you get off an airplane in Jackson Hole is a cowboy on a bucking horse.
Hutton sees himself as a steward of that image, one that these days, he says, is pretty hard to find. Dante Fobla Inkney, KHOL News.
Up next, the Trump administration tried to revive coal in 2025. Did it work? This is Open Spaces.
Hearing one story over and over again gets pretty old pretty fast. On Morning Edition, you'll hear all kinds of stories, from the big news to things that are just fun. Listen to Morning Edition every weekday from NPR News.
From 5 until 9 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kudelska. Our next couple of stories recap some big news from last year. In 2025, the Trump administration threw its weight behind the coal industry.
I call it beautiful, clean coal. I tell my people never use the word coal unless you put beautiful, clean before it. Right, Doc? So we call it beautiful, clean coal. Beautiful, clean coal.
Trump promised to revive it from its decade-plus decline, emphasizing its value as a source of power, energy security, and jobs. In the spring, he signed an executive order.
We'll streamline permitting. We will end the government bias against coal, and we're going to unlock the sweeping authorities of Defense Production Act, the Defense Production Act, to turbocharge coal mining in America. They made it impossible.
These moves were cheered on by many in Wyoming. The state produces the majority of the nation's coal and depends on those revenues. So how did coal production fare in 2025? Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan spoke with University of Wyoming economics professor Rob Godby. They talked at the end of 2025.
So, Rob, how did coal fare this year in 2025?
So this year in Wyoming, it'll be probably the second worst year ever after last year. So, you know, it's not great by historical standards at all. We're about 60% below our height that was about 15 years ago. But, you know, if you're looking for a little bit of an optimistic outlook, it's better than last year. We went into last year with a lot of coal sitting at coal-fired power plants. So they didn't really get a big spring delivery schedule. It really dropped off in 2024, and that didn't happen in 2025. But really the bigger story was that natural gas prices were much higher in the last half of 2024 and the beginning of 2025. And so a lot more coal was used. So, you know, just broadly speaking, coal struggles when gas prices are lower. But, you know, pessimists would have said, well, could it have been worse, I guess? And the answer is, unfortunately, yes. The long-term outlook for coal is that we just continue this kind of secular decline over time. The curve might have flattened a little bit in terms of the trend downward, but most analysts expect that downward trend will continue. And really, it just comes down to cost. I mean, it's just more expensive to run a coal-fired power plant. Over the last 25 years, power companies have primarily built gas-fired or renewable energy power plants as opposed to coal-fired power plants. In Wyoming, the last one was built in 2011, 2012, you know, and that one is considered the only power plant in the country that can compete with renewable energy. And it's right next to the cheapest source of coal in the country.
Are you talking about Dry Fork near Gillette?
Yeah. So Dry Fork is the least cost plant in the country. Yeah. The bottom line is our energy system is evolving towards a renewable basis with natural gas as kind of the fossil fuel backup.
Obviously, the Trump administration has made a lot of moves to try to, I guess, make coal less expensive of an industry or to try to deregulate. I mean, could we see trickle effects from that over the next couple of years where it is more affordable to use coal, or is it still just you're working against the age of power plants?
So that's the big problem, right? So one of the things that the Trump administration has done is use these emergency orders to basically delay retirements of coal-fired power plants. So, you know, there's been a few power plants in the country where literally the operators want to shut them down. And then at the 11th hour, they've gotten this emergency order that says they can't do that. And the justification is usually some sort of grid integrity sort of argument, right? That we need that extra power. And it is the case that, you know, demand has increased and that does put a lot more stress on the power grid. But that has been a real challenge to keep these plants open that we're getting ready to close because they haven't seen a lot of investment in the last few years. So when you know a plant is close to retirement, it's kind of like an old car, right? You get to the point where you say, I don't think it's worth it to put, you know, new tires on it or to replace the brakes. You're just going to drive it until really it makes more sense to buy a brand new one. The other big problem is, you know, the Trump administration will only be around until 2028, and then we don't know what happens after that. And given the fact that, you know, the alternatives to coal just keep getting cheaper and cheaper, natural gas, renewables, you know, we're seeing new types of energy come onto the grid. All of those things make it more difficult to imagine a world 20 years from now that really needs coal to operate the way it does today. So the bottom line is that the Trump administration can kind of bend that curve with respect to the decline of coal, make it a little flatter. But at the end of the day, short of some major requirement to rebuild and to increase the number of coal-fired power plants, you know, the main source of demand for coal, which is power generation, you know, that's going to continue to decline. And as it declines, so will mining.
Yeah. Well, and then this past fall, the Trump administration had scheduled a couple coal lease sales. They were the first in over a decade for our region. There was one in Montana and Wyoming, but the one in Montana got really low bids from coal companies themselves. And then the one in Wyoming was canceled shortly after.
So, you know, in Montana, they literally offered pennies per ton, not even pennies sometimes. You know, effectively, the price was give us the coal for free and we'll take the lease. And that really kind of tells you what the value of coal is in the market right now. There's just really not a need for new sources of coal. There's enough existing coal out there to satisfy the demand in most cases for a long time yet. There are a few situations where, you know, it might be beneficial to get a lease in a particular place because it just helps you operationally. But altogether, the fact that they've had to cancel lease sales when this is such a pro-coal administration tells you that, you know, even the White House can't offset markets. And markets are really the final determinant of whether coal is going to be around in the power generation market.
That was University of Wyoming economics professor Rob Godby speaking to Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan. Turning Point USA's annual America Fest conference in Phoenix in December drew a bigger following than ever. Devout supporters still believe the organization can succeed in the wake of co-founder Charlie Kirk's assassination. For the Mountain West News Bureau, Cameron Sanchez has more. In a note, this story was produced in 2025.
The overall feeling of Turning Point USA's annual America Fest conference in Phoenix last year was triumphant. Republicans had just won a red wave in 2024 and re-elected Trump with the support of every single swing state. But this year, the feeling had changed. 3 months after co-founder Charlie Kirk was assassinated at Utah Valley University, the overall feeling was determination.
We are going to honor him, not just with words, but with action.
That was Kirk's widow and Turning Point's new CEO, Erica. The conference drew a record 30,000 people this year, 50% more than last year. They flocked to the Phoenix Convention Center to listen to conservative speakers. On opening night, Erica Kirk announced that thousands of new churches, colleges, and high schools have started Turning Point chapters since her husband's death.
We are starting 50 chapters per day at Turning Point USA. It's amazing.
About a third of the America Fest attendees were students. Kirk said Turning Point will continue holding Prove Me Wrong events on school campuses and announced the Pick Up the Mic debate tour on campuses for next year. Attendees said over and over again that Kirk's assassination pushed them to become more engaged than ever.
They may not have Charlie, but they've got all of us and everyone who wants to do this for Charlie. And I think that will benefit Turning Point USA and Turning Point Action.
That's 16-year-old Austin Shelley. He came all the way from Rochester, New York, and he's not alone. Just about every attendee I spoke to said the same thing, that Turning Point can succeed without Charlie Kirk. Many of the newcomers are feeling inspired by Erica. In fact, this year, the majority of America Fest attendees were women, 54% to be exact. There have always been plenty of women involved with Turning Point, but Charlie Kirk was especially well-known for appealing to young men. Several attendees say they think Erica is resonating with young women. Erica spoke at several America Fest events, and her responses clearly went over well with the crowd.
I really always admired Charlie, but I think that having a beautiful feminine voice brings out more women to hop into politics.
That's Melody Brittingham. She said Erica's Q&A session was her favorite event.
Yeah, I just think she's a very feminine, beautiful woman, and she is so in love with God. She has so much wisdom.
The power of Turning Point is not lost on liberals either. Across the street from America Fest, a left-wing organization called National Ground Game held a counter-protest at Marley's Sports Grill. Very much in the style of Turning Point, National Ground Game is in the midst of a touring event led by Z. Cohen Sanchez.
I think he was the best organizer of our generation. I mean, it takes a lot to be able to see not just the connection between the media and the ground game, which is obviously super important. He was the only person doing that. But to have been doing that back in 2013 at like the launch of social media, right? Like that is a visionary thing to do. And that is something that the Democratic Party in 2025, we are just now realizing that we should be doing that. That's a problem.
Roughly a quarter of the attendees at the left-leaning counter event were conservatives and America Fest attendees. It's a demographic Cohen Sanchez wants to reach. One of those people is conservative Luke Tagle. He was attending America Fest for the first time, but said he thinks it would be good for the country if the left can put up an alternative to Turning Point.
I want competition, so I want the best idea to win. I'm not someone who thinks that a conservative has to always win.
Several America Fest speakers told the crowd again and again that they need to support J.D. Vance for president in 2028.
We are going to get my husband's friend, J.D. Vance, elected for 48 in the most resounding way possible.
Vance said much along the same lines and pledged to keep Kirk's and President Trump's ideas alive.
I promise you victory. I promise you closed borders and safe communities. I promise you good jobs and a dignified life. Only God can promise you salvation in heaven, but together we can fulfill the promise of the greatest nation in the history of the earth.
Cameron Sanchez, Phoenix.
Coming up, we hear how local community fundraising is becoming more important to some Laramie nonprofits. Stay with us. This is Open Spaces.
Sometimes the news can be a little hard, but Around Wyoming is here to bring you the lighter side of things. Ever heard of frozen chicken curling? Or do you know how many of our residents compete in and win national competitions? Hint, it's a lot. Around Wyoming brings you that and more four times every weekday. You can also find Around Wyoming on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. 2025 was a tough year for nonprofits in a state where many rely on federal grants. So organizations turned towards already existing local community fundraising events. Wyoming Public Radio's Isabel Hunt takes us to the Winter Lights Festival in Laramie's Washington Park.
On a chilly evening in Laramie, kids wrapped in their winter jackets are running around a park glowing with light displays. People admire a tractor wrapped in lights, and couples walk under a lit archway. At a quaint green shack, the Laramie High School Football Booster Club's president sits at the window.
It costs a lot of money to run a football team, and so we help raise money.
Melinda Klinger is fundraising at the Whoville Cocoa Hut.
It helps support any of our lower income families. All of our fundraising comes from local, from our community.
But today, their proceeds won't go to Laramie High School Football.
We're raising money to sponsor local children for Christmas. So we're going to go and take the boys shopping to go pick out toys, and then the moms will wrap.
During December and January, Tough Guys Lighting and Landscaping puts on its Winter Lights Festival in Laramie's Washington Park. The Whoville Cocoa Hut allows charities and nonprofits to sell hot chocolate at the park. They keep 100% of the money. General Manager Brian Welper says the Cocoa Hut is a way for Tough Guys to support their community through charity.
We want this festival where we can provide an experience for the community, but how can we also raise money for nonprofits? That allows businesses to know, like, my money's going to something good. The one thing we always say is, how do we make it free to the public but rich in experience?
Not all of the nonprofit's earnings at the festival come from hot chocolate sales. Every year, local sponsors donate a certain amount to every charity that participates. This combination of sponsorships and sales has been successful.
And with that, and with the Whoville Cocoa Hut, we raised almost $10,000 last year.
On another chilly night, Brittany Brigham is at the window of the Whoville Cocoa Hut. There's a line of people waiting to buy hot chocolate. Brigham is with Laramie Interfaith.
Currently, we have a food pantry that is open throughout the week, and then we also help with utilities and rental assistance.
Brigham says local fundraisers like this play a key role in allowing the charity to carry out their mission.
It's really important to us to build those partnerships within our community, just because we do rely on a lot of grant funding, and when times are uncertain, it's really important that we are able to raise funds to help meet the need in other ways as well.
Alongside local fundraising, Laramie Interfaith relies on federal grants.
We had funding paused temporarily. Now we are still operating and everything is going smoothly, but you know, there's certainly concerns of what the future could bring.
Brigham says her favorite part of the festival is learning about her community and teaching them about Interfaith.
It's really fun to learn more about their stories or see the kids get excited and to be able to explain what Interfaith does. When they hear what Interfaith is able to do, people rally and then they hear how far it can go. So we couldn't do this without our people.
Besides selling hot cocoa, there are a lot of other activities. The public can enjoy a horse-drawn carriage that goes around the park. There's also golf cart tours for seniors, veteran and first responder appreciation night, as well as appearances from Santa. Tough Guys marketing director Brianna Mustad says they hope to create core memories for the community.
Last year, I was standing there with my, at the time, 3.5-year-old daughter, and her body went into what I could only describe as shock. Her whole face lit up, the lights just all, you know, shined all over the park, and I just was fixated on her expression the whole time. I just have captured that memory for the rest of my life.
This year marks the Whoville Cocoa Hut's third year. Other nonprofits will have a turn to look for support from the Laramie community till January 23rd. From Laramie's Washington Park, I'm Wyoming Public Radio's Isabel Hunt.
This is the first month that international visitors are being charged a lot more for some of the nation's most popular national parks, including Grand Teton and Yellowstone. The Trump administration calls this an American First policy. The Mountain West News Bureau's Rachel Cohen reports from a town in Colorado built around courting park visitors.
When Gary Hall hosts visitors to Estes Park, he runs through a long list of must-see attractions and local businesses.
And the best smoothies are at a place like Original Taffy Shop.
There's the iconic Stanley Hotel and a 90-year-old saltwater taffy shop. Hall is the mayor of this charming Colorado mountain town, which serves as the gateway to Rocky Mountain National Park. Starting in the new year, non-U.S. residents visiting the park will face a steep price hike. They'll have to pay an extra $100 per person on top of the regular entrance fees at 11 parks. That includes Rocky Mountain, the Grand Canyon, Zion, Bryce Canyon, Glacier, Grand Teton, and Yellowstone. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum explained the change on social media.
Ensures they contribute their fair share to help preserve and maintain these treasured places.
Around 14 million international visitors toured national parks in 2018. Travelers from the UK, China, and Germany made up the largest share. Hall worries the higher fees send them the wrong message.
We don't really like you, but if you want to come, you can pay a whole bunch of extra money. I mean, that's what it feels like.
And he says whenever traffic to Rocky Mountain National Park slows down, the town feels it.
You decrease sales tax revenue, you decrease attendance at our restaurants, stays in our lodging.
Mackenzie McMillan thinks the surcharge could backfire. He's a travel agent with the Travel Group based in Vancouver, Canada.
International travelers, they're spending a significant more money per day in destination than domestic travelers are. So it's perplexing that they would put up a barrier to international visitors.
But McMillan says the higher park fees aren't top of mind for many of his clients, partly because interest in traveling to the U.S. has already dropped sharply. Starting, he says, after President Trump's talk of making Canada the 51st state. But Tate Watkins says the fees could help parks. He works for the Property and Environment Research Center, which describes itself as a free market conservation nonprofit. Watkins says the added revenue could chip away at the billions of dollars in park maintenance backlogs.
It means that parks have more resources to help serve those people, serve them better, essentially cope with the additional strains that more people inevitably bring.
Watkins published a report on the idea earlier this year. Using Yellowstone as a case study, he found the fees could raise $55 million a year and projected they would only decrease visitation by just over 1%. That rings true for Thomas Pemberton. He's the owner of Estes Park Tour Guides and takes tourists hiking, snowshoeing, and fly fishing. About 1 in 5 of his customers comes from overseas. He says the surcharge could make the park a less appealing day trip, but he doesn't expect a major hit to his business.
If you can afford a vacation in the States for 3 weeks, this is a minor little blip.
But he's unsure how the new policy will work in practice and how it'll be enforced. Back at the taffy shop, owner Mark Eigel packs up holiday orders of pink cinnamon, green peppermint, and red and white candy cane taffy.
It's a tradition for so many families that used to come when they were kids, and now they come with their kids and their grandkids.
He sees the new international fees as just one more hurdle.
Scheduling a visit to the park, timed entry, construction in Estes Park, that every visitor has to deal with in order to come in and spend $20 on a box of taffy.
Eigel doesn't expect a dramatic impact, but he says he'll be watching to see how these America First fees will play out on main streets like this. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Rachel Cohen.
Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcast, and we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Those include Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, X, and Blue Sky. Nikki Woulette and I were the show's editors. Melody Edwards was our audio producer, and Cody Hume was our digital producer and social media manager. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.